What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
I mean, what's the worst that can happen?
I don't know.
Well, the only way you can lose a fight, if you don't get in the ring. Remember that. Okay?
Perfectly good advice when the ring is a literal boxing ring. Less effective if that ring is, say, adolescence.
Adolescence is like the ring and the other boxer and the referee and no one ever wins.
Pretty much something like that. That clip from Sundance hit The Fitz, first-time filmmaker Anna Rose Holmer's inventive coming-of-age story.
Our review plus thoughts on the latest from director Michel Gondry and the new, meh, Star Trek. That and more.
Josh!
Ahead on Film Spotting.
I'm going to say it, Josh. The only thing more meh than the new Star Trek is your meh reactions to Star Trek movies and us arguing about them.
You mean the early Star Trek movies? We were both enthusiastic about the last two. Really liked
true.
Into Darkness, but prior to that is where we have trouble.
Okay, fair enough. We will get to a little more discussion of Star Trek Beyond, the latest from director Justin Lin, a little bit later in the show. And Film Spotting listeners are going to give definitive answers to hard-hitting questions like, which director won the 2000s, and how many Ice Age movies are there?
It's been keeping me up since we first asked that.
I mean, we probably could have found the answer, but we've got a better response from one of our astute listeners. That is all later in the show.
But first, our review of The Fitz, in which Adam and I will try to keep our memories of being team members of a competitive dance team to a minimum.
Ah, the good old days of Sparkle Motion.
You trying to break your wrist?
What do you care?
Dang, dancing has really got you weak. Dang. Hold up. Come on now, Tom. What's wrong?
I'm scared.
Scared? Scared of what? It's all in your mind. Trust me, they're gonna get better.
In an alternate universe, there's a different version of the Fitz, Adam, that would win mainstream audiences' hearts and possibly Academy Awards. The movie follows Tony, an 11-year-old girl boxer played by newcomer royalty Hightower, who joins an all-girl competitive dance team at her local community center. This could have gone the broadly inspirational route, maybe an indie Rocky for our less gender-rigid age. That's clearly not the film first-time feature director Anna Rose Holmer wanted to make, however. Consider the narrative shift that The Fitz makes about a third of the way through. One day at practice, one of the older dancers suffers a seizure, shaking and sputtering uncontrollably. A few days later, the same thing happens to another girl, and then another. Parents and city officials launch an investigation into the community center's water supply. Tony's friend notes that it's only happening to older girls and wonders if it's some kind of, quote, boyfriend disease. For Tony, these Fitz come to represent another fearful rite of passage, one that she may have to face on her way to adulthood. I admire the bravery of this maneuver. In fact, I think it's the sort of bold ambition we look for in a Golden Brick candidate, which, spoiler, I hope the Fitz will be when we narrow down the final list for our annual award. How did you respond to this shift, though, Adam? Do the Fitz and the Fitz add another layer, thematically and aesthetically, to the movie? Or did you find them to be a metaphysical distraction in a film that perhaps should have stuck with the low-key naturalism with which it begins?
There's a lot to unpack there, Josh. Beyond, I think, whether it adds another layer or if it detracts in some way, we can talk about just what the word metaphysical might mean as it applies to this movie. And my basic definition, I guess, talking about something that falls outside of the realm of human understanding or what we understand humans to be capable of. There is a moment late in the film that I think undoubtedly applies, and it's a moment I really like. The actual Fitz, you could certainly argue that the movie is ambiguous about, but not even remotely, let's say, supernatural. I think Holmer here allows for physical explanations for what we're seeing, even if she never ventures any such explanations. One of the strengths of the movies, I think. So I don't really see it as a question of whether this ambiguity elevates it or takes away from it, because if you think about it, without it, there's really kind of no movie. it's, I think, the foundation of what is otherwise a very slim narrative. This is more or less a short story, in my view, one that's really vividly rendered, and it leads to, like a lot of short stories do, an epiphany, ultimately, at the end. So for me to pass judgment on how Homer navigates that ambiguity, it's fundamentally, I think, a judgment on the movie itself. I'm completely buying what she's selling here.
Nice. Good to hear. I think one of the wonderful things about the film is that it is on that line that you're describing and doesn't choose a place to come down. This could have been, you know, a very low-key slice of life drama. But I think the ambiguity that she brings to it, that's clearly the guiding principle. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get the sense like this is why they wanted to make the movie, is to make this leap, whether you feel like it's a big leap or you know, just a little step out into something a little more bizarre. But I think it's stranger than maybe that description you gave sounds. Consider the scene where Tony and one of her friends stick around in the community center after everyone else has gone home. Mm-hmm. And they're running around, checking out the different rooms, having fun. And then they go into the gym where they practice. And a few of these seizures have taken place. And it's very dark. And all of a sudden, you get the sense that this is a ghost story, maybe, or there's definitely a supernatural vibe there. The girls are scared for understandable real world reasons. It's a big, dark place that they're all alone in and that they're not usually at by themselves. Mm-hmm. But also add to that the layer of whatever is going on, this mystery that's going on. And I think this is a very cleverly constructed film in so many ways, including the sound design, which is maybe the one element that gives it a real flair of horror to me. I mean, there are these, if you listen to the background, and this happens very early on before mm-hmm. we get any hint of weirdness going on, there's slow rumbles, there are these threatening rattles, and then this one long horn almost that will repeat that really puts you on edge and hints that there is something else going on here. So you're right. It's a short story in that the metaphor is right there, given to you right away. You know that adolescence is coming and she's unsure of that. She's not sure of where her body is taking her or this major decision. Should I stay with mm-hmm. boxing or should I join the dancing? Where am I going to take my body? It's a pretty simple thing, but by delivering it with such ambiguity and enticing details and atmosphere, I think Homer and her collaborators capture adolescence as an out-of-body experience, mm-hmm. which seems obvious, but I haven't seen many other films depict it that way in quite this way.
Yeah, maybe I didn't feel that same sense of kind of supernatural dread, though I did often feel a little bit of dread, but maybe not as pronounced as you just because of the performance. And I think Hightower's performance is great. I'm sure we'll talk about it. But she's so unfazed about these things. We see it in her actions, but not in her behavior necessarily, or in just her immediate physical reactions to things. She just takes this all in, and we don't really know how she's processing it until she performs some action that then finally displays that. But where I'll support you completely is there are two movies I kept coming back to, or keep coming back to, as I think about this movie, one on my mind as I was watching it, one on my mind later as I was thinking about it and thinking about what I think is so remarkable about it. And the first one is actually The Witch. And I was going to note how different the two movies are from a content standpoint, right? This is mm-hmm. a movie set back in, what, the 17th century, the 1600s?
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, long time ago. And this Puritan society, a family cast out, and it is decidedly supernatural. We definitely see those elements come through. But then it occurred to me, Josh, that they're not that different. The primary character in both is an adolescent or a teenage girl dealing with a new environment, confronting new desires. They're both on that fragile precipice of discovering who they are as young women. And so that's there. But take it a step further and take it back to the metaphysical. There's a certain hysteria that takes hold there.
Yes.
In the fits, just like it does for the family in The Witch. What I was thinking on a much more basic level, though, is all the same phrases that I heard you and Michael Phillips use when you were praising The Witch as one of the top five films of the year so far apply for me here in terms of the director's control of tone and mood, through building that subtle sense of dread, the way the camera moves through these halls, how it frames and how it shows the perspective of the main character, the pacing of the edits. And you talk about the sound design with you completely. I think maybe even more provocative is that terrifically unsettling score by Danny Bensey and Sonder Juryans. You're so right. Everything we talk about in a Golden Brick contender is on display here. Clear directorial vision, artistic ambition, though here on a relatively modest scale. This isn't the other movie I was thinking about, but as I was jotting down my notes, it reminded me a little bit too of The Neon Demon and conversations about that film, where I think this is largely an exercise in style, like that movie is, but it's so well executed that the style ultimately creates substance. All the meaning is derived from that style.
It is amazing what Holmer manages to do with this really mundane setting. We hardly leave the community center, mm-hmm. and these are gyms, these are hallways, these are locker rooms.
I'll say I was confused and actually thought it was really a school, a big school okay. with a lot of different rooms and a boxing ring and those kind of things. But it could be either place because we just really never get outside it.
We don't. And they're such familiar spaces. But her choices of when to go widescreen mm-hmm. and allow the actors who are all athletes in some way to use all that space and move, or the times to go claustrophobic, like in the locker rooms, are really key. And she makes this a visually striking film without having to find a setting that will help her do that. So she brings it all out mm-hmm. in the choice of the camera work. I love the witch comparison, which did not come to me at all, but that is so good, especially the two climaxes.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't want to spoil how this climax, but
good point. You
make that comparison, and maybe we can just say that what is in common there is perhaps this idea of possession. Mm-hmm. Let's just tiptoe around it that
yep.
way. And that brings to mind another point of comparison I had in this film, and it was actually Beyoncé's video for Formation that came out just at the time of the Super Bowl. It also involves a competitive dance team. And I think if I remember right, it's been a while since I saw it, but there are sequences in an emptied swimming pool. Maybe this is coming from Lemonade, too, that I'm thinking of. But dance sequences in an emptied swimming pool, which also occur here. So you have that, but you also have this idea. There are church scenes in Formation of the Pentecostal and charismatic tradition, this understanding of being slain in the spirit. So it's being, you know, giving your body over to the Holy Spirit and results in seizure,
mm-hmm.
seizures, convulsions. And that is a thread here, too, that I don't think Holmer is necessarily pushing very hard, but it's yet another one of these ambiguous possibilities that's going on. And I love how the movie plays with that in the end. And I don't know which might have come first, the conception of this film or the Formation video, but there are such clear echoes along these lines between the two that I like how they do speak to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Hightower's performance is the one thing I was trying to, you know, child performances are so difficult, and she's absolutely arresting. There's no doubt about that. But this is distinct in that the movie doesn't draw much force, I would say, from her personality
no.
or her performance. As you said, she's
an observer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely true. There's not a lot of dialogue in this film
no.
overall, and she doesn't get much either. Yet we're drawn to her, and I think it is because she has a presence,
yeah.
so you do have to give her credit for that. And the opening scene of her doing sit-ups where she comes into focus mm-hmm. and she comes to her knees and looks right at the camera.
Mm-hmm.
There's a boldness to that that
yes.
I think hooks us. So she has that. But I also think it's in Holmer's decision, again, to focus this movie primarily on bodies. And
mm-hmm.
then this ties into the out-of-body idea as well. But we see so many things like just close-ups of feet skipping rope, or the girls dancing in a middle shot where it'll get aggressive and they'll almost like attack each other with a dance
yeah.
move. And that echoes boxing, right? So you can see why Tony is intrigued by this. It's
mm-hmm.
not necessarily because it's girly, but maybe because it's competitive
yeah.
in that way. So I do like her decision to really focus the camera on bodies and how they're being sometimes measured and changed. There's a shot, there's a great edit here, and I forget now which comes first, but I believe it's the boys being weighed for their next boxing
mm-hmm.
match, and a quick cut, and maybe it's the reverse of this, sorry if I'm getting it wrong, but a quick cut then to Tony being fitted for her dance costume.
Right.
And it's again this idea of, you know, controlling bodies, her letting her body change in a way that maybe she's not sure of. And I just love all the little touches that the movie finds to emphasize that.
Yeah, I'm with you. And the other movie I was going to mention as we're talking about echoes here, and I really don't think it's about reference points in the sense of Homer trying to reference these movies or necessarily being inspired by them, but in terms of me processing why this movie works so well for me, it really made me think of Under the Skin as well. And Sam and I were talking about this, and he mentioned how that's another film that made similar use of its score.
Yes.
To always keep you a little bit unnerved. And I agree completely, but the real connection for me is in how Jonathan Glazer in that film and Homer here use point of view. And yes, there is this ethereal quality too. There's something a little bit otherworldly about both films and about both stars. But we start to see and experience the world in Under the Skin through the alien perspective of Scarlett Johansson's character. And I think Tony is kind of like an alien too. This gets to your out-of-body notion, right? She's kind of like an alien in this world of these older, more mature dancers who are all doing things that she can't do just yet or isn't quite capable of, but has a certain longing to. And you've touched on this a little bit, but she's frequently isolated in frames. And there are a lot of close-ups. That opening is an example where she's coming up to the camera doing sit-ups. The background behind her, very blurred. We don't really see what's going on. We know that some people are boxing, but they're not very distinguishable. So there's this really use of shallow focus. And it's often straight on with Hightower filling up the whole frame, looking at us as if the camera is her mirror. So we instantly start to develop that identification with her. And just some examples of how that identification then really takes hold. When she's in the locker room, that first locker room scene after dance practice, we hear what she's hearing based on where she's sitting. Mm-hmm. We see what she's seeing based on where she's positioned. At one point, she's changing in a stall instead of out in the room. She goes into the stall, and she's kind of eavesdropping on two of the older girls, I think two of the captains of the dance team, and we see them from her perspective through that slit in the door. And so I just think that heightens that connection to her, where we become not only connected but invested in everything she's going through because of how the camera positions her. It becomes a sort of symbiotic relationship between us and her, where our experience, as I said, is heightened because we experience the world the way she is. You mentioned how there's an investigation going on in this film. It almost makes it sound like that's a real plot element. It's not.
It's like a reference.
It's alluded to
it, yeah.
It's referenced, but the way it's referenced is at one point the dance coach is explaining to everyone in the room, maybe they shouldn't drink the water or hear some new developments. But because the camera is by her and because we hear it as she would hear it and we're paying attention to it just as much as Tony is paying attention to it, it is never given any more focus than that. It's all about her and how she's experiencing it. And it's not ever about those plot machinations. So that for me is really what captivated me about this movie. And as I've said all that, right before I came in here, Josh, I caught a line from the critic Bilge Abiri from The Village Voice. And he said in his opening line, in Anna Rose Holmer's The Fitz, emotion becomes motion and psychology becomes space, which I think so eloquently and so poetically sums up everything you and I just spent about 7 minutes saying. He nailed it there in one sentence.
That's it. That's why there isn't a need for dialogue. More dialogue in this film would be redundant. Another example of what you're talking about Tony being a figure apart, is when she's in the halls. This is more towards the beginning. How much, how frequently is she moving in one direction and then a flood of the dancers will come out in the other direction?
And they're celebrating kind of, and they're cheering or doing whatever.
In her demeanor, in her direction, she's very different. So my favorite scene in the film.
Oh, yeah, I know where you're going. I got to know where you're going.
It's hard to say because the climax is just so ecstatic. I mean, it's exhilarating.
Yeah, but
But it's on the bridge.
There's a breathtaking scene, the overpass.
Yeah. She goes to this overpass. It's caged. It's a long take, but very delicate use of when to move in. And this, again, goes to this idea of transition.
Mm-hmm.
Tony
literally starts doing the transition.
Yes. Tony starts doing jumping jacks, which are part of her boxing routine on this bridge. And then suddenly it sort of morphs into the dance routine that she's been learning. And just as she starts doing that, this clicking, the rhythmic clicking on the soundtrack comes on, and the camera slowly moves in on her. And at first you think, no, don't do this because we want to see her whole body in motion. That's what you've been doing all along. Mm-hmm. And you know, she's starting to perform this routine. We want to see how she pulls it off. But then I noticed the closer we got, one thing we get by being that close to her is we see her smile.
I'm so with you on
and
this.
She hasn't really smiled that much. Sometimes with her brother who works at the community center as well, and she has a really close relationship with. That's how she got into boxing, we assume. But really often she's observing again. She's hooded and she's quiet. And here we get this little smile.
Yeah.
And even describing that, it maybe sounds like it is a Rocky moment, like this transformation moment. But it isn't, to me, it wasn't her becoming a dancer.
No.
It wasn't that she now nailed the routine. Because if you notice, her dance moves incorporate boxing moves.
Like, yeah.
She doesn't fit with the team because all of a sudden she'll impulsively let out a punch. And I just love that she brings it to – she's making the dancing her own. So this isn't like she finds a way to become a girl. Really, the end of this movie for me, it doesn't matter. The point isn't what does Tony become through this experience. The point is just that she's transformed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's enough. That's all this movie really needs.
You could really discuss what you make of that transformation and whether we see it as – quote, good or bad. That's mm-hmm. too simple.
Or even what it is.
For sure, yeah, or even what it is. And I agree with you that that's something that makes this movie so provocative. But so much for me having a unique take on that scene. I'm with you. It's absolutely the standout sequence in this movie. It sounds like we both might be fighting over it as a scene of the year candidate.
Put it on the list.
At our rap show in 2017. But I'll try to add this. It is so wonderful to watch, of course, partly because it's all captured in one take. So there is that element of watching her physicality, which you talked about her performance and the fact that she is often very kind of deadpan, or she's not someone who's reacting in her face or emotionally to what's going on. But there's still something to her performance in just watching her move through this space, right? And watching her make that transition. That's what's so great about it. It's not just that she goes onto this overpass and she decides to practice and all of a sudden the dance moves click. It's that we actually do get to watch her practicing for boxing. She's running to be in shape for boxing, mm-hmm. as we've seen her do with her brother earlier and at different points in the film. And she naturally, as she is taking swings and doing various boxing practice moves, she just instinctively, I think, transitions into those dance moves.
It's like, it's what her body wants to do.
Her body, that's it. It's where her body and her mind finally merge. And that smile, I was wondering if you would notice it, because this is what makes it so great. What makes it not be that kind of cheesy moment or a Rocky type moment is Homer never cuts to her face to show us that. She gets closer. Yes, but at no point, once she's figured out these moves and once we recognize that smile, does she cut to a close-up from the front so we can see how joyful she is. The camera stays exactly where it is because that smile is hooked directly to what her body is doing, and it requires us as viewers to be paying attention to notice that bit of elation that finally comes through on her face. So just every right move there with that scene.
That's a remarkable choice to make for a first-time feature director as well. Like you said, to put the trust in the audience and not to oversell the emotional key to the scene at all. So right there, along with the other things you say where you feel like there's such control behind the camera here. Yeah, Marks Homer is a hugely exciting talent.
The Fitz is currently out in limited release. It's playing in Chicago starting this weekend at the Gene Siskel Film Center, but it is playing around the country or is rolling out to other cities and other screens over the next few weeks. If you want more information about that, we will link to the official website for The Fitz in our show notes at filmspotting.net. And if you see it and agree or disagree with our takes on it, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
Oh, please don't make fun of me with my crooked smile and my crowded teeth, or my pigeon feet, or my knobby knees. Well, I got problems than not, but I feel fine, and I made up my mind to live.
is a stranger who comes to this village from the sea. He comes in the winter when people are hungry and brings fish. He comes on the king tide.
That was last night.
Talk.
The Justice League trailer there that made its debut at Comic-Con last weekend. Ben Affleck resuming his role as Bruce Wayne in the Zack Snyder-directed film. It's due in 2017. The trailer introduces us to Aquaman, to Cyborg, and to Ezra Miller's Barry Allen slash Flash. Now, why are we talking about the Comic-Con trailer? Because it is not like us, Josh, to spend much time on trailers.
You generally avoid them.
Or Comic-Con. Yes, I do. And it's also not like us to be that excited about a Justice League movie, even though as a kid, I certainly spent many an afternoon watching the Justice League cartoon, the Super Friends.
Was it afternoon? See, around these parts, it was Saturday morning.
No, it was afternoons.
Okay.
Yeah, afternoons back in the great state of Iowa, Josh. But I couldn't help it. Being on Twitter over the weekend, I saw that they had unveiled this trailer and that responses seemed to be pretty positive on it. And what I was getting at is we've had not only a little bit of fatigue about superhero movies in general, but fatigue about Batman and Superman after seeing Batman v Superman, and maybe some Zack Snyder fatigue. So I was not anticipating devoting any energy to watching this trailer, but then because of those social media responses, I did watch it, and I just got to say, I think it looks pretty great.
You're in? Pretty great?
Yeah, pretty great.
Okay, calm down.
Well, I'm not saying the movie will definitely be great. The trailer is pretty great.
The trailer's okay. I mean, Affleck is still sleepwalking.
Yeah, but he's liked Affleck. No, I liked Affleck in Batman v Superman.
What?
Yeah, I thought he was wonderful.
That
as
last, yeah, we didn't talk about this on the show together. That
was
last
one of the only good things about
that
the movie.
Is setting this up where I think at one point Gal Gadot like nudges him, like, you haven't finished your line yet. Wake up.
Oh no,
he's
going for something. He's
I'll
making choices
in the trailer. In the trailer, I do like that he finds a new way to say I'm Batman by throwing the batarang. That was a nice touch. And
I like Affleck's Batman.
Also, Aquaman, you know, I didn't realize he was
Jason Momoa.
Yeah, I didn't think of this character as a kid as being like any sort of badass, really. But
no,
that is where they're
kind
going
of the least
here.
Cool super friend, without a doubt.
Yeah, and it kind of works. Great shot
really works.
This trailer of the wave hitting him and he like doesn't move an inch.
Yeah.
So that's nice.
Ezra Miller. You're not excited? You're not excited is what you're saying.
I'll see it. See it. I'm excited.
Okay.
I'll see it.
Well, I do love Ezra Miller. I think he's a very talented actor, going back to After School, a movie that we talked about with the director here on the show at a live event in Chicago. But he's a really talented actor, and I liked his Flash a lot and the repartee there with Affleck. And I was thinking about this a little bit, Josh. I don't know how it is going to play out over the course of a 2 hour or let's say 2 hour and 40 minute movie, whatever
least.
It probably will end up being. But I was trying to get at the core of why this trailer maybe excited me more than it did you or some other people. And I think it goes back to the fact, actually, I heard Kevin Smith say this. He said, it's a getting the band back together movie, except the band never existed. The band was never together.
Yeah.
So essentially, of course, what it is getting the band together movie. And something in me is drawn to those types of movies and even those types of cartoons. Did you ever watch, I haven't thought about this in 20 years, but this trailer made me think about it. Did you ever watch a show, I think it was only on for 1 or 2 years in the mid-80s. I would have been about 10, you would have been 11, 12, called Mask.
I'm thinking of the movie Mask.
It's a cartoon called Mask, and maybe here our intrepid producer, Sam, will cue up the music because the theme music is really, it's a wonder. It's something to behold. The whole show is about
GI Joe-ish.
And there's this whole thing about them being this crew, but they all go about, they're not superheroes, but they all go about their lives, and then they'll get the call that they got to
action heroes.
They got to stop a bad guy, and they all have a special
figures,
skill.
I mean,
yes,
this?
So like their car will turn into a special vehicle, or the motorcycle will turn into a helicopter. I used to love that show. My favorite part of the show, though, Josh, was honestly, it wasn't the action or whatever. It was when the main guy would get the call that something was going down and they needed to assemble the crew, and it wouldn't be the same guys every time. The computer would basically decide based on the mission who the best people were and give you the rundown of their skills. Something about that always appealed to me.
There is a computer scene in this like that where they're all, I see. All right. Well, so, if this is your mask, you might be
Justice
a happy
League
boy.
Justice League is bringing out the 10-year-old in
me.
Happy
boy.
Yeah, I'm excited. There were some other trailers making their debuts at Comic-Con. Wonder Woman.
I thought that one was more exciting, actually. I mean, it looks like she's definitely, I mean, she has it, right? She's got the part nailed down, it seems. And I like that they're leaning into the feminism angle, unless they plucked every bit of that from the movie and put it in the trailer, which could be. But you know what I also liked about it? It seemed to be really embracing the mythology, and not that I'm all that familiar with the original comics, but what you see is a lot of world building of the mythology. And I thought that worked well, which this reminded me of, in the first Thor movie, you know, where they kind of went all nerd in a way. Like, we're going to, not just try to avoid the fact that he's a thunder god from a planet or whatever it is, but we're going to just really embrace that. And I thought that was kind of fun. So this looked similar.
I'm glad you mentioned feminism, because I did want to throw out a question to you and to our audience, mainly to our audience, because it follows on our discussion of Ghostbusters. And remember at the end of that, you threw out that idea that actually our friend Wendy Weber mentioned about Trinity in The Matrix and the tight-fitting clothes. And then we've got Kate McKinnon wearing the baggy jumpsuit and what that says. And I brought up the idea of how Beatrix Kiddo fits into that and whether or not Carrie Ann Moss truly is a sexualized figure. All, again, up for discussion.
No real
clear answers there or a real clear point of view. But watching the responses to the Wonder Woman trailer, which I did not see, and seeing responses from women I follow on Twitter who are very clear about calling themselves feminists, they're fired up about this movie.
Yeah.
And it's hard to not look at Gal Gadot and look at her in the Wonder Woman outfit. And of course not.
Oh, she's, she's
not,
in the
not
tradition.
Not see her as a sexualized figure.
She's so, in the tradition of the sexualized action heroine.
So yeah, I would just love to hear a little bit more about how those women who are really excited for Wonder Woman see her fitting into or not fitting into how Hollywood typically depicts heroines.
I mean, you know, to me personally, I'm not taking that. For me to say that I think it's a step forward for a female action character to not be depicted that way doesn't mean that having them be a sexual being is off the table in any case. You know, it's not like to ever do that would be bad. It's a case-by-case situation.
Valid.
And here, I think probably the defense I would assume is that you are working with a property that has been around for decades. And so you could play it up one way or the other. Yes, there are shades, but you can't really put Wonder Woman in a jumpsuit. So I think that's probably why giving a pass is maybe the wrong phrase, but she might, this character might be given a pass is because there's a tradition here. Now, will the film tweak that tradition in some of the costuming, in other choices that it might make? And the trailer flashes past pretty quickly to be able to tell beyond the fact that they haven't, you know, completely abandoned her as a sexual figure. So we'll see. It'll be an interesting way to look at the film.
Yeah. And there's a gray area there because you can say sexual figure as in boys in the audience watching her are turned on in some way or whatever versus actually her character being someone who has any kind of sexual identity, which I kind of have to imagine we're not going to see in a Wonder Woman movie. But maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe that's all tied into the mythology, Adam.
That
we'll
would be
find
great.
Out.
I really hope that's how it plays
out.
Did
we just spend 25 minutes on trailers, by the way?
I think we did.
New segment.
Well, and we didn't even mention that Lego Batman was also debuted there. Kong Skull Island, King Kong origin story with Brie Larson, Tom Hiddleston, and Samuel L. Jackson, and Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. That comes out November of this year, a Harry Potter prequel set in New York City. Finally, a new Suicide Squad trailer, and this is a movie that I'm not going to get to review here on the show. I'm going to be off next week. Josh, you are going to have a guest host, Angelica Bastien, who is a really talented writer based out of Chicago, and from what I understand, from what you've told me, someone who is very much steeped in this world of DC Comics.
Yeah, I got a chance to meet with Angelica, and we did talk a lot of comics. She's an aficionado. She got me re-excited for Suicide Squad. Just, you know, not that she thinks it's going to be a surefire win, but that it's a really interesting property, especially a DC property, to be coming out as a film. So we're going to review that, and then this will be related to your Wonder Woman question. Our top five is going to be top five women comic book characters done right. So I'm sure we'll be touching on some of these same questions you just brought up.
I can't wait to listen. Again, that will be next week on Film Spotting. For our local Chicago listeners, we have some movie passes, more movie passes to give away. Josh, always happy to do that, including passes to Gleason. This is a documentary about the former football player for the New Orleans Saints, Steve Gleason, who developed ALS at age 34. It opens here in Chicago on August 5th. And there's going to be an advanced screening on August 2nd. That's Tuesday at 7 p.m. So if you want a chance to see that movie for free in advance of its release, you can enter right there in the top story section of filmspotting.net. And also, we've got some passes for Kubo and the Two Strings. This is an animated epic fantasy. It's the latest from Laika or Laika, Josh. I'm not totally sure, though we are familiar with their work, certainly because of Box Trolls and Paranorman and Coraline, a film I greatly enjoyed. I know much beloved by you. Kubo opens on August 19th. The advanced screening is Tuesday, August 9th.
I'm taking the family to an advanced screening, but a different one, so I won't be able to run into film.
They let you bring
listeners.
Some guests to that one.
Yeah, I believe that's an open invite, so you might want to do the same.
I will look into it. Okay, the burning question that everybody's been dying to know since it was thrown out. Was it you, Josh, who threw it out just as kind of a
if it was
little
me,
bit
I,
of a goof?
I deeply regret doing that.
You asked
that.
How many Ice Age movies yes. there were.
By the way, that was a question. Sometimes I ask these questions that right. I didn't really care to hear the answer to.
I know. I didn't either.
Yet.
You were curious or not curious,
no,
but
not
you
at
threw
all.
It out there, and I suggested that I thought this latest, which opened last weekend, was the fourth Ice Age movie. If you weren't curious, really, about this series at all, well, it seems that a lot of moviegoers were with you, did pretty disappointing business at the box office this past weekend for people who care about such things. But of course, with Film Spotting listeners being our very own on-demand film Wikipedia, we got an answer to your question without Googling it. We thought we'd share it. Andre Cadeau, longtime listener in Charlottesville, Virginia, longtime commenter as well.
Hey guys, no doubt you've been inundated with emails regarding the number of Ice Age movies.
Weren't.
Just one, right?
I think just Andre.
Okay. There aren't three, there aren't four, but now there are five, as you can see from the attached graph. Wow, there was a graph with
yeah,
this?
Yeah, he went into it.
Andre, the Rotten Tomatoes ratings have gone down with each Ice Age release, making it look like a ski slope. Maybe number six will finally get them to the bottom and into the resort. They can enjoy a couple of cognacs and put an end to our misery.
So that ski slope, pretty much my college experience from freshman year to senior year. I know what that graph looks like. Thank you, Andre, for the information. A couple of weeks back, we asked you an incredibly convoluted question that we already knew the answer to. This one we knew the answer to, or we thought we knew. That question, in a nutshell, which big budget director won the 2000s? The options we offered, directors who emerge in the 2000s, Josh, doing their best and most successful work to date, and they were bringing some measure of artistic integrity, as determined apparently by us, to their big budget productions. We gave you Alfonso Cuarón, Paul Greengrass, Christopher Nolan, Steven Soderbergh, or other. Josh, how did it come out?
We had the right choices because other came in last place with 2%. Paul Greengrass only managed 3%. Bit of a jump here for Steven Soderbergh. He received 11% of the vote. Then in second place was Alfonso Cuarón with 16% of the vote. But yeah, Christopher Nolan, as we expected, won it with 68% of the vote.
Andrew in Provo, Utah. While there is no doubt that Cuarón, Greengrass, and Soderbergh all made excellent films in the 2000s, no director had a greater influence on millennials and 21st century big budget films than Christopher Nolan. As Juliet Littman, Tate Frazier, and Chris Ryan explained on the Channel 33 podcast a few months ago, Chris Nolan is really millennial Steven Spielberg. In a society where box office successes generally have to be sequels, prequels, or animated movies, Nolan's name alone seems to be able to bring audiences out in droves. His success in the 2000s has earned him enough credibility with audiences that they'll come out to see Dreamy Heist and Love Conquers All space movies. I'm sure that today most film studios would be wary about a film that's about World War II's Dunkirk evacuation, but with Nolan attached, it's almost a guaranteed hit next year.
Yeah, I don't know if that came up at all when we were considering the options and talking about it, but the fact that he creates original material, obviously the Batman trilogy stands apart from this, I think really does speak in his favor. We also heard from Isaac Rosso Klakovich in Chapel Hill. I knew that Nolan would win this poll, but I didn't think there would be this large of a discrepancy between him and the other directors. And while he might be the best choice, I went with Greengrass because he's not getting the love he deserves. The Bourne Ultimatum is the best straightforward action movie of the 21st century, but it's United 93 that earned my vote. Making a film about 9/11 that isn't overwrought with emotion is a near impossible task, but somehow Greengrass pulled it off. And it's not just what United 93 doesn't do that makes it great, but what it does do. It perfectly captures the despair of that day, unlike any other film has done or will do. Watching the air traffic control room descend into chaos is one of the most despairing sights in recent cinema, and allowed someone like me, who didn't really live through 9/11, I was only two, to truly comprehend the tragedy of that day.
The always insightful Aaron Teachman, don't let it go to your head, Aaron, in Washington, D.C., says, for me and my film life, the winner of 2000 to 2009 is Alfonso Cuarón, and he did it with just three movies. Y Tu Mama Tambien is a classic of world cinema. His socially aware coming-of-age story handles not just the complicated lives of these three people, but wrestles with the state of Mexico's soul as well. The Prisoner of Azkaban is the best Harry Potter movie.
Agreed.
Standard disclaimer, I disagree. I haven't read the books, yada yada. It significantly advanced the visual look of the Harry Potter world. I definitely buy that. Azkaban is the first story that really gets dark and maintains a tense mood of foreboding that would come to dominate the series later. The core cast got significantly better at acting in this film, and they handle the greater emotional depth of the story very well. I think the director should get some credit for that, and Children of Men is a bona fide, unquestionable masterpiece, and in my opinion, it is the only film of all of these directors from this decade that rises to that level. Emphatic.
Here's what we might have forgotten.
Aaron is.
Chris Justice, hold your ground, hold your ground. I have no defense my pick here.
I need more Massacre Theater
so
acting there, Josh.
Hold back the hordes from hell before the onslaught. I may get my film spotting pass revoked from the Dark One, that's Josh, apparently, or Saruman, Adam, but I have to say Peter Jackson won the 2000s for making three movies that surpassed everything I could have wanted and transformed the way I think about and watch fantasy films. Lord of the Rings. It is simply the greatest cinema trilogy of all time. Please forgive me. So this was, Lord of the Rings was before
There's
my time on the show.
There's only one trilogy, Chris. Haven't we learned that?
I'm a huge fan. I can't believe I forgot about this as an option. I don't know if I would put Jackson past Nolan for this, but he'd probably get my second place vote.
Really?
I mean, yeah, all three of those are pretty amazing. They're not original material, and do you just consider them one mammoth film? I think that would maybe count against him for me, but yeah, this should have been an option.
I hope you don't count them as one mammoth film, because if you did, then I haven't seen any of the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Wait, which ones have you seen?
I've only seen the first one.
Well, we're
and
not
I liked it. I liked it very much, actually.
This go that and that filled your
the one that won
that
the Oscar
lifetime
nope.
need
Haven't
for fantasy. I'm assuming Tolkien based fantasy, because I know the Hobbit films were never an option to review on the show, and turns out they were okay, but probably didn't really
didn't
need to
we
be
actually
reviewed.
Discuss the first Hobbit movie on the show? I think that's where I learned.
Did we?
Yeah, I think we did.
How
that's
did that
where
happen?
I learned that I had seen enough.
Okay. So you were going back for the other two after seeing the Hobbit film.
So here's the question. What will come first? Me watching 2 and 3 in the Lord of the Rings trilogy or Gone with the Wind?
Oh, Gone with the Wind.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. I could see that happening first.
Well, Christopher Nolan apparently won the 2000s. That question begs another question, though. Stand down, everyone. Hold your ground. Not another poll question. One we discussed briefly a couple weeks back that is, who's on track to win the 2010s? Who are today's equivalents of Nolan, Cuarón, and company? Joe from Salt Lake City hazarded a guess.
Hey, fellas. You guys were discussing up-and-coming directors who've shown prowess as filmmakers and made the jump from small indie films to big-budget productions. But you missed one of my favorites, and that's Gareth Edwards. He hasn't done too many feature films, but he's on his way to his third. His first real feature was Monsters in 2010, made for under $500,000, which he clearly stretched and turned it into an absorbing alien/journey picture out of it. And someone at Legendary must have loved it, because he was then suddenly handed $150 million to make Godzilla a couple years later, which I thought was fantastic in that it took Godzilla back to his roots, you know, like battling other giant kaijus like himself rather than humans. Now he's wrapped up in Edwards is now wrapped up in a little movie called Rogue One, a Star Wars story, right? And I expected him to deliver nicely there.
So Edwards was one of those filmmakers I was sort of thinking of. I think I had said something about people who have been handed superhero franchises. So this doesn't exactly apply, but it is the sort of franchise that he did, in my opinion, well with. I really like that version of Godzilla. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we'll see what happens with Rogue One. A lot of questions surrounding it at this point, but coming out this year. We heard from Aaron Teachman also on this question.
I told you, always insightful.
I've been mulling this question for a few days since I first listened to the episode, and I put together a list of five directors who might be able to claim this decade with strong second halves, beyond the few you already mentioned, like Rian Johnson and Guillermo del Toro. There are a lot of caveats. That's half the fun, right? Also, Aaron says, I wish this list wasn't all men. Here they are listed in ascending order. Colin Trevorrow. This is the classic example, right? Aaron says, Safety Not Guaranteed is a great little indie piece. Not enough people saw it, but the right people did. And he lands Jurassic World and then a Star Wars episode, The Big Kind. Jurassic World? It was only a success, really, in financial terms.
It follows the model, though, of indie director taking on big budget spectacle.
Wait a minute. There was something in here. Let me go back to bringing some measure of artistic integrity to their big budget productions.
I guess we will see what we get from the Star Wars installment because, yeah, I'm with you that we didn't get much of that in Jurassic World.
All right, Aaron also suggests the Russo brothers. Okay, their background is in television, something that I'm certain is going to become more common in the future, but still, it was a huge leap to Captain America Winter Soldier, which, as we all know, was pretty good, as was Captain America Civil War, I would say. Joss Whedon is another suggestion from Aaron here. He also made the leap from television, but managed a relatively small movie in Much Ado About Nothing, which is fairly slight, but it was bookended by the first two Avengers. I don't know. You're not a Much Ado About Nothing fan, are you?
I really thought it was Much Ado About Nothing.
Yes.
It's unfortunately a very, very poorly made Shakespeare adaptation.
Aaron's other pick here is Gareth Edwards, and then he goes with one more, Matthew Vaughn.
His number one, basically.
His number one is Matthew Vaughn.
Yeah.
This is the first name that I thought of, and he still has the best shot. Sadly, Layer Cake and Stardust don't belong in this decade, but Kick-Ass is still basically an indie, and it did well within the parameters of an R-rated action movie for an obscure comic, and he definitely elevated the material, the abysmal sequel demonstrating how poorly that material can really be. He made the X-Men with the Fassbender in it, and it was quite good. Instead of getting plugged into another big machine, he booted a franchise with Kingsman, including sharing a screenplay credit. Plus, he's still doing stuff like I Am Pilgrim, a spy thriller that's still in pre-production, which might be terrible but is not Marvel, Star Wars, or Furious related. And he gets points for that in my book.
Okay. Well, an inspired pick, though maybe a misguided one. We'll see how listeners react to Aaron's comments. But he backed it up. He backed it up with a lot of support. That brings us to our new poll, which we'll just say is not nearly as convoluted as this last one. There are no spin-off questions to wrangle with.
It's not a poll question unless there's a spin-off question.
Yeah, we'll see. Or if we have to make a change to the question. This has us looking a couple weeks ahead on the movie calendar to the release of Sausage Party, an R-rated animated comedy that is the brainchild of Seth Rogen and his writing partner, Evan Goldberg. This question is about as sophisticated as Sausage Party looks. A simple death match here between the two most prominent raunchy animated comedies. They both happen to be products of the South Park team. So is it Bigger, Longer, and Uncut? Or is it Team America, World Police? You can only pick one.
And death match rules apply, right? The one that's not chosen is
gone forever.
It's gone.
Yeah.
Okay. Is this hard for you? Did you favor one of these strongly over the other?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Really?
Not hard at all.
So both of these made, in the years of their release, my top 10 lists.
Okay.
But I think it's fairly easy for me simply for the inventiveness of Team America, World Police. That it is, if we're talking about it in Nolan terms, an original production compared to an adaptation of the TV show, which I thought they did brilliantly, but still, Team America is the one that I need to hold on to.
Yeah, I think Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, if I remember my reaction to it clearly, it's been a while now. I remember thinking it was mostly hilarious, but also it wore me out a little bit after a while. I think all the scenes with Satan and Kenny just, I don't know, Josh, it didn't make me laugh that much.
Okay.
I'm not entirely sure why, but Team America World Police from start to finish is brilliant. Just brilliant. So that's my choice. We want to know what you think. I think this is going to be like a 72-28 winner. Team America.
Probably that sounds right. I mean, unless you have people such huge fans of the show itself that they cast their vote that way.
Well, you can cast your vote now. Filmspotting.net. If you leave a comment, and we hope you do, please let us know where you're listening from. A bit of music there from the fifth film in what will be a 7-film contemporary Nordic cinema marathon from Aki Kaurismäki's 2011 movie Le Havre. This is a marathon focused on films made since the new millennium, mainly, and it's our second film from Finland's Kaurismäki. We also discussed 2002's The Man Without a Past, and we covered 2 films from Swedish director Roy Andersson as well. Last week, Suzanne Beer's In a Better World from Denmark. And this happens sometimes, not designed at all, Josh, but like The Fitz, another movie that actually employs a little bit of the metaphysical by the end of this movie. We get just a glimpse of it, but a prominent one. And this is a movie that is set in the French harbor town that gives the movie its name. Our protagonist is Marcel, an older, little, weary shoeshine man who lives with his wife and encounters a young African refugee named Idrissa, who he ultimately decides to help. On Letterboxd, Josh, you writing about this movie mentioned that it expresses its social consciousness a bit more emotively than The Man Without a Past did, but you note, rightfully, that when we talk about a motive in the context of Kaurismäki and his characters, that means, as you put it, blinking during one of the many extended portrait shots in which they stare off screen or directly into the camera. It's pretty deadpan, safe to say. Not only is there no real emotion that comes through, there's arguably nothing really even resembling drama. Forget the occasional full-blown melodramatic spurts we got in Beers in a Better World. There's plenty of potential for drama. A refugee on the run, an inspector in pursuit, a wife dying of cancer, and a husband trying to help the refugee evade the inspector and get his wife back home. And yet Marcel and so many others we meet in this movie navigate any despair and tumult they encounter with merely a sense of melancholy matter-of-factness. Did you find Kaurismäki's exaltation of human decency compelling, despite the lack of any internal or really external conflict? And if you didn't, was there something other than Le Havre's endearing optimism that grabbed you?
I did find it compelling. I like this film. I wouldn't say I liked it as much as The Man Without a Past. And the distinction really for me was the fact that this social consciousness was, yeah, not emotive in the fact that people are crying or gesticulating wildly, but that not long into it, you realize this is a socially conscious film. I think The Man Without a Past, it wasn't until, at least for me, well after the movie was over and I started really thinking about the characters and their predicaments that I thought, wow, this is saying some really interesting things about
characters on
class.
The fringe.
And it sort of like bubbled up from the story. And here I feel like it was more imposed on the story in a way. It's still an enjoyable experience, and the uniqueness of the way Kaurismäki does handle a scene and the emotional tone of a scene is going to hold your attention. And so I enjoyed it for that fact. But it's almost like I got the sense that this wasn't really taking place in the real world, a real Europe that's facing any sort of immigration crisis, but it's the world that Kaurismäki wished there was, and
yes,
that this particular boy's story is the way every refugee story would play out. So I think wish fulfillment came up.
Yeah, in a fantasy version.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think wish fulfillment came up in our review of In a Better World.
It did.
Did you bring it up, or
yes,
it was in another reference?
No, okay. I did, yeah.
I find this to be even more wish fulfillment.
I was going to say that.
I don't know that that's necessarily a negative thing, but it did put me maybe a little bit more at a remove from the story and the characters than I had for those in The Man Without a Past.
For me, a little bit more of a negative, that wish fulfillment aspect within A Better World, because that's a movie that does at least purport to be more gritty and realistic.
Yes.
It's
yes.
not a fairy tale, which this ostensibly is, but you're absolutely right. I was thinking about In a Better World and that wish fulfillment idea. That movie was basically saying that title, which we should say is the English title slapped on that movie.
Yes.
It's not the actual Danish title, but it's basically saying in a better world, the type of ugliness and horror and misunderstandings that this movie presents wouldn't occur. And Korosmaki's La Havre, I think, is that better world, actually. It's that better world. So many people here do so many things that are either against human nature or they just make no real practical sense for them to do. I mean, there's nothing in it for them at all. And I think what the director does establish is the idea that these people in Marcel's immediate community were never particularly bad people. They're a little bit coarse with him. They seem maybe a little bit worn out by the way he takes the bread and he hits the bar.
He's behind on his bills a lot.
Yeah, behind on his bills, and they aren't big fans of his, let's say. But I think what Korosmaki says is they're not necessarily bad people, and they aren't or weren't necessarily particularly good people either. But that's only because they were never presented with an opportunity
they rise to
show
the
their goodness. That's it, right?
Yeah.
So there is, Korosmaki seems to say, an innate goodness that was just waiting for these characters to bloom as soon as the storm hit. And that means that we do have a movie, as I mentioned, a lack of real drama. And I would say too much of a lack of drama and too much of a lack of stakes for me to be really excited about this movie. But it ultimately becomes a movie that's not at all about the mechanisms of change as a society or as an individual. Mechanisms that are, of course, almost always messy, even when they do play out successfully. It's simply about the doing. It's about the act itself. There's a moment where Marcel goes to the woman who has the shop on the corner and says, "I have to go away for a few days. Will you watch Idrissa?" She says, "Yes, I will." There's no deliberation. Mm-hmm. There's no hesitation. There's not even at that point really a sense that she has a firm understanding of exactly what's swirling around this situation. Just, you ask me for my help, I'll give it to you. Later, we see a character who actively tried to avoid Marcel, then going to him and saying, "Are you in need of any groceries?" He knows the answer to that question, and he gives him some. So, yes, once they have a time to shine, they do rise to that occasion. So, I suppose I find that optimism and that sense of the benevolence of the human spirit to be endearing. I don't know that I find it much else, though.
You know, I wish I had noticed this and written it down. I did notice it. But what you're describing puts into better context a little throwaway moment where he talks about being a shoe shiner, and doesn't he say something about this is one of the profession, one of the only professions that follows the Sermon on the Mount?
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
He mentions that.
And so that gets to this
something
idea
about interacting
of,
with people directly and
service, you know, serving others.
That's it.
So that ties very much in with what you're saying. And I appreciated that about the film. Maybe it's, you know, it's not a very strong through line for me to have been a main hook. I don't know that there are many very strong through lines in this. It is still a slice of life. I do like that, like The Man Without a Past, it pays attention to what life sort of on the edge might be like. This man and his wife are scrimping along to make it day by day. And then they're faced with this health issue and you get a sense of what that might be like for someone in their situation. So I do like the scenes in the bar where there are the guys who just hang out all the time and this is their daily life. It paints a nice portrait in little pieces here and there as an overall narrative structure. Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you were describing, you know, whether there's drama or not. Part of the issue is that it seems to forget about the drama it's created at times.
Yeah.
So Idrissa is at some point can barely be, he's got to be in the water so
right.
that no one sees him. And this is a maritime town. And so he's down by the docks and he's hiding out, actually standing in the water. Mm-hmm. That creates this sense that he's in danger at all times. And then a few scenes later, Marcel will send him off on an errand. You know, and so that kind of deflates this sense of, well, how watched is he?
Mm-hmm.
And again, you could say it's all in the context of this fairy tale feel, which it does have, and maybe you need to give it a break that way. But for me, it was, you know, the narrative deflates a little bit.
Yeah, the lack of dramatic stakes is really present here when you have people who aren't wrestling against themselves, really, and they're not really wrestling with anyone else. And this is a movie, of course, that doesn't at all mind the refugee plot, the African plot for melodrama, the way that Beer does. But there is, I thought, Josh, something still a little too flimsy about the way Idrissa, you talked about this in terms of the danger he is in or should be in, is handled. But his struggle and the struggle of his people who have come over on this cargo ship and have been stuck there for who knows how many days without water, or probably without water.
They're in a cargo container.
They're in literally
and they're
a cargo container
in until
and later,
the police yeah, open it.
That's yeah. it. And we see a scene where he visits a refugee camp. There is really no struggle at all to any element of what they go through. And Idrissa himself is not much of a character. He's kind of just the embodiment of need for these people to help him, for all these other non-refugees to rally around. And I don't really find that troubling because, again, I'm going to give this movie a pass largely for being a fairy tale. I mostly just found it boring in that I wish there was something more substantial and I suppose a little less quirky to all of these characters and the way they're portrayed and their struggle, especially with a character like Idrissa.
I agree with you on Idrissa, but I do want to call out one scene that I think is more a pointer of what could have been. It's when Idrissa goes to visit Marcel's wife, who we should say is played by Kati Otinen, who was in The Man Without a Past.
Yeah, Karismaki regular.
Yeah, and so Idrissa, who's played by Blondin Miguel, I'm not sure if you mentioned his name, mm-hmm. but he gets a nice conversation with her there, and they talk about Marcel, and that opens up a little bit of what kind of kid he is. That's all we needed,
yeah.
right? We needed a little more than him to be the figure in trouble at the corner of the room, which he is largely throughout the film. Now, a touch that I really like that's somewhat related to this topic is when they do open that container, Korosmaki takes the time to, you mentioned at the top how I referenced the portrait shots he makes of mm-hmm. people staring either, if not into the camera, right off
yeah.
to it. He does a portrait shot for each person in that cargo container. Mm-hmm. And that is the sort of thing that, again, it's not telling us their whole story. Mm, it's not giving no. them the screen time that the other characters give. But it is pausing to say, which not enough movies do, even this, these are people too. This person has his or her own face, his or her own story. Now, maybe that then makes the rest of the movie lacking when they are forgotten. Or as you say, he goes to this hangout. It's a refugee hangout, mm-hmm. really, more, and they're just seeming to be doing just fine. And even how the film ends too is like, he'll be just, you know, it'll yeah. be just fine. These
yes.
people made good, right decisions. Everything will be fine. And
they'll all be rewarded.
Perhaps it's just watching it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perhaps it's just watching it in this time now where those are not the stories we are seeing or hearing at all when mm-hmm. it comes to immigration and refugees and migrants in Europe, that this seems a little bit jarring. It could just be a timing thing.
I don't disagree with you, but it's ironic that you praise the time Korosmaki gives to those faces in a way, because someone could easily counter that with the fact that none of those faces he shows react in any noticeable human way that
but
we would expect those people
but does
to
anyone
react.
In a Korosmaki film? I mean,
yes,
they were
you're right.
they were being directed. I guess that's how I took it.
Totally.
They're being
yeah.
directed like any actor in, yeah.
Yeah, no, they fit into this universe. And there is something just odd about those people, maybe, those people who have gone through what they have gone through to get to that point.
Sure, not responding
to still be reacting
yep.
like a Korosmaki character. But I was thinking about The Man Without a Past and that main character, Marcel, very much like M. And that was a movie about a man with memory loss who didn't feel like he had to go back and retrace his steps or figure out, quote unquote, who he really was. He was all about just going forward. And I asked, should we all be so lucky as to be unburdened by our histories and by our vices? I thought that that was unique to this story about a man suffering from amnesia. And then I see another Korosmaki film and I realize, no, that's just who his main characters maybe are. They're the kind of men who they don't reflect on where they've come from. They don't spend
I don't
any time.
Know about that
they don't spend
here.
Any time thinking about their future. Marcel, I would argue, getting back to that notion of just doing, they don't think about the complexities of
that's true
of society, of their place in society, of all the ramifications of everything that will happen if they do a certain act. They just live life and do a certain act.
Yeah,
they
within
perform
their,
the act.
Within their daily sphere. That is true, though I do like the touch here that Marcel references his wife's past and the previous husband she had. And that was just a little bit of past world building that to me did stand out from The Man Without a Past.
Yeah, I can see that. The look of it, too, very much in line with Man Without a Past,
yes.
a film that has that sort of caught between two worlds. It's definitely something that feels more real than what we would get from Roy Anderson, maybe that real absurdist black comedy. And we get the feel for this neighborhood or the little community and the surrounding area. But it's also a case where, because of that kind of odd Technicolor out of the 50s look to it, and the way it all feels like it's been painted, like everything has been painted
and heightened colors,
heightened in a way where, like
just
I said, yeah, that's it. It's more down to earth, and yet at the same time, something so heightened about it that doesn't feel at all natural. It feels like all of these homes and all of these shops, to me, are on a movie set. It looks like it was lit and all takes place and unfolds on a studio lot. I don't think that's the case, but he's very much going for that effect. And it's something I appreciate, the artifice of it. It's something, as I physically watch it, I'm not drawn to at all. There's something about that lighting. There's something about that just caught between reality and artifice that it doesn't draw me in. It's not an added layer that draws me in anyway to Kurosaki's films.
In this case in particular, he seems to be guided by the blue that there is location shooting being done here. And as I said, it's a maritime town, so there's an industrial sense to it. You see the waterway, and it's a little bit of a grayish blue sky, and that sort of filters into the color scheme overall. So when I think of this movie, I think of blue. And and it's not the dull gray blue of a seaside town.
No.
But it's not an extremely fully technicolor blue. It's like some melding of the two that does create its own ambiance.
Mm-hmm. La Havre is available via Netflix and for rental via most digital platforms. If you see it, you agree or disagree with us, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Next up on the schedule, we are planning to discuss 1001 Grams. This is from Bent Hamer, a 2015 film. He is certainly a Norwegian auteur. As we understand it, we are trying to hit all the countries here in this region, and we're going to close it out with a film from Iceland that we actually haven't decided on yet. Some people have suggested a film that for a lot of people is considered a 2016 movie, Rams, a movie from Iceland. We are looking for a good Icelandic film to discuss, but I'm not sure we'll be able to get our hands on that movie. It's not out right now.
I think it may be just out. That's why we were looking at it.
We've waited a long enough period to get through this marathon. Yeah, we've drawn it out enough that we can see that movie. So that might be the one we close with. But next up is 1001 Grams, and you can get it via Netflix DVD, Netflix Instant, or iTunes, or Amazon. We'll have a lot more details coming about this down the road, but we're excited about a partnership we're going to embark on with one of our longtime partners, Mubi. They're a curated online cinema, of course, brings its members a handpicked selection of great independent, international, and classic films. And those are exactly the kinds of movies, usually off the beaten path movies, that are blind spots for a lot of people that make up our marathons. And so we're going to partner with them for future marathons. So if you always have trouble participating because there are so many different places to find these movies, or sometimes you can only get them if you go to your local library, if you're lucky enough to get it there, you just don't feel like it's accessible and easy to keep up with. We're hoping that Mubi is going to help alleviate that problem a little bit, and a lot of these marathon movies will be available in one spot.
It could be the perfect solution. I mean, we're careful to pick ones that at least have some availability, but even then we know it's a little bit of work to keep up and say, now where is this one, and get it in time. If we're able to do this with Mubi and the marathons are all in one place, that would be brilliant.
Mubi is only $4.99 a month, and they introduce a new title every day, and you have 30 days to watch it. You can also download their films to watch offline via their mobile app. Our listeners can try Mubi free for a month. If you want to wait to try that out until we have some of those more details and we announce our next marathon, that's fine too. Just go to Mubi.com/filmspotting, Mubi.com/filmspotting. A quick plug for some of the things they have now that you can check out: the Brothers Quay series, that's a big blind spot for me. They've got an exclusive introduction from Duke Johnson, who was the co-director of Anomalisa, and Trust from Hal Hartley, part of the same wave as Richard Linklater and Todd Haynes. Hal Hartley's Trust is one of my favorites. I love, love, love this film. That's available now. And Zatoichi, this is from the acclaimed art house director Takeshi Kitano, rebooting Shintaro Katsu's 26-film Blind Swordsman action series. All those movies available right now over at Mubi. I don't want to be funny anymore. I don't want to be funny anymore. Lately, I've been feeling like the odd man. I heard my friends saying things that don't mean I. donation time, as we have a few new donors we want to thank and a couple of great comments to share as well. We start with Jesse Marsh. Jesse is a guy, Josh, who wrote to us and donated initially last November, who explained that he needed a fix after the Dissolve shut down, and he caught a few episodes of Film Spotting and basically was so hooked, he went back and started at episode one. And now he writes again after donating again. Thank you, Jesse. And explains that he has now made it through the episode 300 extravaganza and made another donation accordingly.
Jesse says, at this rate, I should be completely caught up by the autumn of 2017. And in case you're wondering, I really tried to avoid half-assing this marathon and to really commit. I even made sure to check out all the Film Spotting Fix episodes, revisited Best Of episodes, and After Hours episodes along the way. This is a completist.
Commitment.
Still haven't seen Roger Dodger, though, so there's that. Anyway, wanted to thank you again for the great show, and I'm psyched for the next 300 episodes, or the previous 295 episodes, depending on your perspective. I do keep current with the next picture show. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And every once in a while, I do check out your current episodes, so I'm not totally living in the past.
Great to hear from you again, Jesse. And it was fun at the time. I, of course, knew back in November that we were about to launch the Next Picture Show podcast after he was praising the Dissolve folks and wanted them back in some form. And I wasn't ready to lay it on him yet, but I just said, basically, if you like those guys, stay put, stay tuned. You're going to be happy. We also have two new $5 a month subscribers to the show, including Jeffrey in Woodbury, Minnesota, and a guy who we should probably be paying, Josh, for his contributions to our many poll questions and other feedback we get from him along the way. He is Billy Ray Bruton in Los Angeles.
Longtime listener and commenter and occasional snarky corrector. I was a $5 a show donor for a while and then it stopped. I've been meaning to resume my cinematic philanthropy for a while now, but it seemed appropriate to do so when it could possibly accompany a shameless plug. My debut feature film, Show Yourself, world premieres at Bruce Campbell's Horror Film Festival in Chicago on August 19th at 10 p.m. It's the third year of the festival, and we got the thumb up from the man himself, Bruce Campbell. I describe the film as The Big Chill meets The Changeling, the George C. Scott film, not the Angelina Jolie one. It's a dramatic horror film shot in the wilds of Southern California that subverts a lot of the traditional horror tropes you've come to expect, unless we failed miserably. It also co-stars a Film Spotting favorite, Stephen Cohn. As a mildly pretentious film director, fiction does not mirror real life in this case.
Yeah, Stephen, who has been on the show and I've had the pleasure of having come to my class and interact with a little bit, is just genuinely one of the nicest guys in the world.
It doesn't really fit, no. I must also add that one of the characters is named after Adam, first name only.
How about that?
I was going to give Josh the same level of appreciation, but we ended up writing out that character prior to shooting.
Love it.
Sorry,
Love
Josh.
Love it so much.
I'll
Sorry,
make it
Josh.
Up to you on the next one. How that hurts. Regardless, happy to support however I can. I listen to the podcast every Friday like clockwork. Fridays just aren't Fridays without Film Spotting. You guys are the Vin Diesel and Paul Walker of film podcasts. And if you gents aren't busy on the 19th, head on down to the Movie Co. Rosemont 18 and check out some delightful horror flicks, mine included, and maybe share a drink with Ash himself. Keep up the grand work, and I can't wait for that John Cassavetes marathon I've been demanding for years. You've marathoned the Fast and Furious series, but not Cassavetes. Let that sink in, guys. But since I just compared you to Vin and Paul, I guess it makes sense. Ride or die.
Yeah, hashtag ride or die. Well, this will be very easy for you, Josh, because you are actually already planning to attend on August 19th. You're doing a one-person panel on why The Evil Dead sucks. I think Bruce Campbell just really wanted to have that dialogue.
No, it's going
to
be me and Bruce.
That forum.
It's going to be me and Bruce talking about that. Yeah, that's not happening.
Well, I wish it would happen. I think Bruce Campbell's fans would respond to that nicely. But congratulations to Billy Ray. Excited that he's got that opportunity. I wonder if I actually will be able to attend. I mean, I have a character named after me for crying out loud. I looked
Sounds
at
like
IMDb.
You've got to be there.
Fifth character down. There he is, Adam. He didn't call me for any advice or any insight into
Should you
playing
be
me.
Worried?
I don't think he's playing me. But.
Should you be worried that there's no description of this character? I mean, you might go expecting this will be like going to a Malick film that you've been cast in
right.
and you find out that you get half a line.
I'll take it.
You're going to go and this is like some moron, this character.
Half a line more than you got, Josh. A no-cost way you can help the show, of course, rate or review us on iTunes. Since we've been making this request, as we've noted, we have seen ourselves be even more visible on iTunes, and we appreciate that. So our thanks to everyone who has rated us or written some nice comments over the past couple weeks.
Yeah, I'll read the books.
My dad joined Starfleet because he believed in it. I joined on a dare.
You joined to see if you could live up to him. You spent all this time trying to be your father. Now you're wondering just what it means to be you.
So no top five this week. We'll get back to it next week, Josh, with your guest host. But we do have a little review roundup because apparently we had enough free time last weekend. And even with me fitting in all of Making a Murderer with my wife to see a few movies. One, in the case of a movie I'm going to mention that's actually been out for a couple weeks in limited release, but is still rolling out to new cities. And one that opens this weekend here in Chicago and in select cities, and one that comes to us from a director who we both have been fans of, and I know a lot of our listeners have been fans of in the past. It's Michel Gondry, his new film, Microbe and Gasoline. Tell us about it. Do you recommend it?
Definitely. The thing to know about Microbe and Gasoline, I'm someone who has a high tolerance for his brand of found object whimsy, this overburdening creativity. I can go a long way with that. Loved his last one, Mood Indigo, which probably pushed that as far as it can go. Microbe and Gasoline dials way, way back. This is a movie that resembles The 400 Blows more than it does Be Kind, Rewind.
Really?
Or something like Mood Indigo. Yes, it's not that it's more emotionally true, because I found Mood Indigo really emotional, wrecking actually, but it is more realistically based in its emotions. It's just a story about two friends, teenagers. They're both misfits to a degree, and they meet up at school. One is a new kid. There's a little bit of In a Better World to this, but it goes in a very different direction. And they decide to build this car together. Here's where a little bit of the whimsical comes in, and take off, run away essentially on this road trip across France. And you think, well, this is where the thing's going to go full Gondry, right? It's just going to be this car. I mean, Mood Indigo had a cloud car floating above Paris. But he keeps even the montage of building the car to a minimum and really emphasizes the dynamic between these two leads, who are amazing. Ange D'Argent is one of them, who's a brand new actor, and the other kid is played by Theo Baquet. And their dynamic is, it's just wonderful the way they capture adolescence. Again, we're back to the fits here, but particularly from a boy perspective, rings so true. And it was warm-hearted in a very genuine way. I smiled throughout the whole thing. The way people have been talking about Sing Street, including you, kind of captured how I felt during this. So I think it has that same, from what I understand, sense of warmth and what it feels like to be that age. And yeah, it felt like a really personal film, you know, in the way that The 400 Blows does as well in terms of boyhood. So absolutely recommend it, particularly for those people who may be feeling exhausted by Gondry, whether they still like him, but are like, I just don't need another one like that. It's not like that. That's what you should know.
So I didn't get a chance to see that, but I did catch up with a film that I think by now actually has probably ended its run here in Chicago. It was playing at Facets, opened on July 15th, and it's a movie called Nuts, and that's N-U-T-S with an exclamation point. A movie that I think maybe came up on the show back when Steve Procopi was here and he was previewing the Chicago Critics Film Festival. I'm almost positive, 99.9% positive that it played there at the fest. And maybe the best way to set it up is to just read the initial one-sentence description from the movie's website. Nuts is a feature-length documentary directed by Penny Lane about Dr. John Romulus Brinkley, an eccentric genius who built an empire in Depression-era America with a goat testicle impotence cure and a million-watt radio station.
To cure your impotence, you want me to implant goat testicles into you.
Well, Doc, that can't be worse than the nuts I got.
Well,
there you go. That's a movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie, and it sounds like the kind of movie that Michel Gondry might make, though he wouldn't need to base it off of real life. He would just create the character Dr. John Romulus Brinkley. Penny Lane, by the way, apparently her actual name.
Excellent.
Not a gnome de plume, if you will. And she is the director as well of a documentary from 2013 called R. Nixon that relies heavily on archival tapes, Nixon's archival tapes. I have not caught up with that film, though I am eager to see it. Nuts is a film that I can recommend primarily because, as you heard, the story is so incredible. The fact that this person existed, the fact that he had the impact that he did during the time span that he did, and yet he's a character that I figure has been lost to history. I don't think any of our listeners probably knew anything about Dr. John R. Brinkley unless they had seen the movie Nuts. And some of his achievements and some of the things he's famous for or infamous for are astounding. And it's a film that mixes talking head kind of interviews with animation. So it animates his biography. And that is kind of the template for the film, or the foundation for the movie, is it's giving us his story as told by his biographer.
Okay.
It does have, or I should say Penny Lane has, a little trick up her sleeve. There is a little bit of a reveal. There's some new information introduced, and the movie takes a little bit of a turn that I think is maybe meant to upend things and meant to be more profound, ultimately, in terms of saying something about our relationship to celebrity and our attractiveness to myths and how susceptible we are to mythologizing. I think, as I said, the movie wants that moment to hit with a greater impact than it did for me, and I'm not entirely sure why it didn't, other than the movie does give you some hints along the way that it might be going there. I think the tale itself is so fantastic that it'd be hard to not start to wonder if we're going to get some contradictory information maybe at some point introduced. And I don't think that's a spoiler to say that that information is introduced. But again, fascinating story, fascinating man at the core of the story. And we'll link in our show notes to the movie's website and more information about how you might be able to see it. There is a rollout schedule for more screens and more cities here throughout the summer. That is Nuts. And that brings us to, finally, Star Trek Beyond.
Yes.
Josh, I know vaguely what you thought of it because I saw your Letterboxd rating, but I don't know.
You can see the excitement in my eyes.
And I can see the excitement in your eyes, but I otherwise don't know your take on the movie, and I want to hear it.
Yeah, you know, it's fine. No, it's not fine. It's on the wrong side of fine, but it's close. And
so it was just on the right side of fine for me. That's
okay.
The difference between us
yes,
here.
This is going to be a very spirited
not going to be much of a battle.
What was interesting about this is I heard, after I went to see it and wrote down some thoughts, then heard some other people saying, enjoyed it, but, you know, man, this is taking it way in another direction, even further than J.J. Abrams was taking it from tradition. That was the opposite of my experience. And cards on the table, as listeners know, I am not a huge Star Trek fan. I appreciate a small number of the films in this franchise, and this one felt to me, but I'm very familiar with them, having seen all of them. This one felt very much to me like one of the first five or six, not in terms of its scale. So the special effects are there. It's a big Hollywood release, obviously, but just in terms of the ambition, maybe the narrative scope, and it just left me a little, okay, it was sort of a backtracking. There wasn't a lot of excitement to it. I did like a few things. I think that Justin Lin, who made my favorite installment in the Fast and Furious franchise, which isn't saying much because he made, what, four, right? I think he made four of them. So
Three or four. How many Ice Age movies are there?
Oh, please. So yeah, he, you know, it was a good chance he was going to make one of my favorite. I think he brings some good things to this. I don't think he's able to quite match the use of practical effects with the action that he did in those films, in the Fast and Furious films. There's
just a
ton of CGI here. But there are a few moments that are fun. I do want to ask you, though, and I usually don't talk about this because I figure it can be such a theater-to-theater presentation experience, but I do want to ask it because I've seen two other people now, one on Twitter and one on Letterboxd, mention as well. This was the worst presentation experience I've had in a long time in a theater. Now, I went to a theater I'd never been to before in Chicago. It's where they had the press screening. And I thought, maybe this is just a dumpy place. It was 3D. I was forced to see 3D. I actually watched like 3 minutes of this blurry because to
thankfully,
put those 3D glasses
experience
on would have been so dark. Mm-hmm. Here's my question for you. So dark, I could not see what was happening. So I took them off and watched part of this movie blurry just so I could see. Hmm. Did you find the darkness to be an issue? Because two other people specifically mentioned darkness and for some of these scenes.
I didn't.
Okay, so
I saw
it
at a theater that we both frequent and on its big screen in its biggest theater. And yes, made sure to see it not in 3D. And the brightness or lack thereof was never an issue. Okay, presentation was great.
Good. Well, that's good to hear. I mean, you know, you don't want it to be like the cinematography or something like that. It must have been just that venue and mm-hmm. the 3D bad combination. So yeah, obviously avoid 3D when you can.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm just on the opposite side of you. I can recommend this movie. And it's funny because I knew we weren't going to review this film. I didn't really think we'd talk about it at all. So I did jot down a couple thoughts over at Letterboxd. And basically the way I did it is I said, I'm recommending it not because of these aspects, but because of these aspects of the film. And after I did it, it felt very familiar to me. And I went back and looked at my review, I think, of Star Trek Into Darkness on Letterboxd, my comments, and it was basically do's and don'ts. So there's something about these films that brings out the binary in me where it's just about here's what's good and here's what's bad. I do think that's more of a reflection of my lack of imagination as a critic than these films. I'll say that. But there are aspects of this film that I definitely could see your point in terms of the lack of maybe narrative ambition. I think that's probably a good way to put it. There are a couple narrative moments that really I just don't think make sense at all, including the inciting incident that sends the Enterprise out on this mission, is not believable in the sense that you don't believe that these characters, all of these Starfleet characters, would be so naive to kind of just embark on this. We get no real deliberation. Lynn doesn't seem to have any interest in giving us any of that deliberation. He wants to get to the action. I think Idris Elba as the villain here is really underutilized.
Total waste.
In terms of those plot machinations and his motivations as a villain, they're a mess. Yeah. There's really no clarity to them whatsoever. What I did like about the film, and I did catch one or two suggestions online that said that there are fan service elements to this film, but if there were, they were subtle. That was one of the problems I had with the first J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie. And I'm a fan, generally, of Star Trek. The TV series, I've said before, was one my dad got me into, and I spent a lot of time watching Nick at Night reruns of Star Trek. But the devotion to trying to pay homage here, introduce characters here, I thought, kind of like with Ghostbusters, really weighed that movie down. I didn't notice it here. Yeah, I mean, there were elements that I caught that I knew were from the TV series, but again, didn't feel burdened by it.
I'd agree. It's pretty free of that. And it's definitely the baton passing is largely over. So that was a relief. I'd agree there.
There is a great action scene, I think, at the finale of this movie that involves a great musical cue that just is.
That is Lynn's moment.
It's Lynn's moment. And let's say it, despite being these jaded, cynical film critics, Josh, one of the reasons we do go to the cinema still is for those types of spectacular moments.
Sure.
To get that thrill from a spectacle. And he delivers there.
Yeah,
he definitely does.
To match the image and the motion of the image with that beat in Sabotage, the Beastie Boys song.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that's what you're talking about.
I am.
I mean, it's just,
which was used in the trailer, not a giveaway.
It's irresistible, and he makes it work. So.
I think the difference between me and you primarily is I just enjoy spending time with this crew maybe more than you do.
Okay, but let me ask you, did it have enough of the Kirk-Spock dynamic for you? Because for me, I thought that is what Abrams and also, of course, Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto were really building very much in Star Trek Into Darkness, this compelling dynamic, which I know longtime fans will say has always been there.
Yeah.
But I think that we have two better performers here. I'm just going to say we have two more charismatic, better actors. And that is a relationship that I had begun to become invested in with these last films. And it's really set aside. It sort of bookends this story. But other than that, they're apart way too much for me in this film.
So that definitely struck me as well. And I was a little disappointed by that, certainly initially and maybe about halfway through this film, because that for me has also been one of the real pleasures of the past two Star Trek movies, is watching those two actors and watching that dynamic between those characters. But even though I still wish it had more, and it sets it up as if that's a huge part of this movie, right? And then doesn't really go down that path. I still like the fact that we get a similar but different dynamic that is really at the core of the story between Spock and Bones. And Carl Urban is a lot of fun here.
He's great.
He really is great. And then what it does do, and by the plot design, it ends up splitting up this crew into pairs. And
yeah, different teams.
That's why we don't get that pairing of Kirk and Spock. And I guess in the end, I was a little bit happy and a little bit grateful because it did give Simon Pegg and Anton Yelchin and John Cho and various other characters a lot more to do. It made them truly feel like a big part of this crew and a big part of this story, as opposed to kind of the also-rans to Spock and right. Kirk. So I did like that. And I think that everything about their larger dynamic as a crew, and this is where I think Lin does add his element being Justin Lin, not just in the action, but in the way he turns this crew into a family. The guy who gave us a lot of that mm-hmm. in Fast and Furious, I mean, it was there from the early beginnings of the Fast and Furious movies, but Lin made it into what those films are fundamentally
about.
Yeah, what
they're about, right.
And I think that's where you see his signature really come through in this movie. And these characters, because we get a greater sense of them as individuals and them in this smaller collective, how they all do then come together, they become more than just a crew. They become a family here. And so we get some of that stuff that we get with families, where we get more secrets. We get those kind of unspoken moments between people where things are left unsaid that maybe should be said or don't need to be said. And I like that. And like I said, I like these characters. I like them going back to the original Star Trek series. I like them as they're embodied by these characters. And they would, I guess, have to really go off course to find me in a position where I was responding really negatively to them on screen.
Yeah, to me, this felt like a bit of a course correction, honestly, to get things back to that sort of sensibility. It does what you're talking about is emphasizing this teamwork, which mm-hmm. is, you know, a major theme, and this sort of utopian sensibility, too, of coming together to be this unified force of good in the universe. All that is very reminiscent to me of the earlier films more than the last two. I'm just curious, would you, not that it is a good or a bad thing, did it strike you more as a throwback, or did it strike you more in line with the previous two, or was it some sort of perfect combination?
I'll just say it's not something I thought about as I was watching it or even right after until I saw some comments along those lines. And once I saw people making that comment, of course it made sense, mainly because this does feel like an old episode of the series drawn out to 2 hours where
right.
it's really about one mission, and they go down to a planet and hell breaks loose, and then it's about them getting back to their ship. I mean, it certainly does feel like a throwback to, I'd say, the TV series much more.
Yeah,
that's okay with me because I like those episodes. But I do want to just lastly mention here that I think Matt Singer wrote a really good review of this film. If you're one of those people who maybe thinks, and Josh, you kind of suggested this is where you fall, that there's not a lot of ambition narratively, it's not really trying to say anything and doesn't pull off saying anything, if that's what you're suggesting, or if you're like me, who's saying that despite Lin's insistence on focusing on the escapism and the action element to this movie, it still manages to say something about the times we live in. And that was just a very Shatner-esque moment for me there. I don't know if that will come through to radio listeners, but that pause and my hand gesture, yeah, wow, I'm channeling the original James T. Kirk here.
Or but whatever it was he sold.
It doesn't spell out being about the times we live in the way I think the Abrams movies do, but by the end still does manage to say something about the times we live in. Matt and I disagree on, I guess, the extent that Lin emphasizes that, but I just want to throw out there for listeners who are curious. I think Matt makes a really strong case.
And I will say, when it comes to Star Trek, you should absolutely listen to Matt first, because
right.
he's definitely more of the aficionado. But I think in this case, one of the things I liked about Star Trek Into Darkness is how it directly wrestled with very pertinent, specific things
right.
that were going on at the time. Yes, Star Trek Beyond speaks to a need for unity, mm-hmm. as I said, and, you know, teamwork, not dissension, but I think in a very generic way, and in a way that much of this franchise has spoken to, and it's much more that we're feeling a need for that now than that the movie is offering that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But
because I think you could watch probably more than half of the Star Trek movies that have come out and say, they speak to us right now. And that would be true. So I'm not saying it's not there, but I don't think it's as precise or as intentional or as incisive. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for. I think Star Trek Into Darkness was much more incisive in terms of being any sort of political allegory.
Well, and someone else might argue that Star Trek Into Darkness is simply more heavy-handed and more direct about wrestling with some of those larger philosophical questions. And Matt certainly articulates this way better than I could. But what this movie does more subtly in talking about not just teamwork and unity, but unity across all sorts of races and differences, this movie shows it. This movie shows it in the way the entire crew of the Enterprise, in a way that you haven't seen in the previous two films, Josh, is given time here. And when you see them all together on screen in lots of wide shots showing this crew, the diversity of people spread across that group, the fact that they're always all wearing different colors, they're not all the same members of the Starship Enterprise that are wearing that kind of gross cream mustard thing that Kirk wears, whatever. It doesn't spell it out for you necessarily, but it's there and it still means something.
This is a film that ends with all of those people coming together in a group hug almost and staring up wistfully into the sky.
Yeah.
That's not subtle.
Kumbaya,
I mean,
Josh.
That's not, you know, not arguing with the message, but I don't think you could say it's subtle.
Well, we disagree on that, but Matt Singer says it much better. We'll link to his review in our show notes at filmspotting.net. If you disagree with us or agree with us on Star Trek Beyond, or if you want to share any other comments about the show, you can do that. Just email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
How about leaving us a voicemail so we can share it on a future show? The number there is 312-264-0744. You can also find Film Spotting on Facebook and on Twitter. At Film Spotting, that's Adam. I'm at Larson on Film.
Out in limited release this weekend, opening here in Chicago, Right Now, Wrong Then. This is the latest from Korea's Hong Sang-soo. He was the director of the least loved film in the 2013 Korean auteurs marathon, Woman on the Beach, but I don't think we should let that discourage us from seeing this movie. It's gotten a ton of praise. His work overall has gotten a ton of praise from a lot of people I trust. A little bit of a blind spot for us, despite that inclusion in the marathon. And this is one I hope to catch up with. Also out, a movie recommended by you, Josh, Microbe and Gasoline from Michel Gondry, and one strongly recommended by both of us earlier in the show, The Fitz. Out in wide release, Nerve. This is from Catfish and Paranormal Activity 3 and 4 directors, Ariel Schulman and Henry Joost. Bad Mom, starring Mila Kunis, Kristen Bell, and Catherine Hahn. And Jason Bourne will file this under Please No It Can't Be. Our buddy David Ehrlich on Letterboxd wrote, it's very, very, very bad.
No.
And gave it 1.5 stars.
But I already bought my tickets.
Well, I did see someone respond to him on Twitter today who said that apparently he's in the minority. I haven't seen the critical assessment yet of this film, but according to that Twitter user anyway, David is in the minority. So we're going to hope that he's just insanely wrong.
That's
about Jason Bourne. Next week on the show, Josh and Chicago-based film writer Angelica Bastien will review Suicide Squad and share their top five female comic book characters done right. You guys are going to include graphic novels. Is that my understanding?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Josh also will tell us how Debbie did end up liking Jason Bourne much more than David Ehrlich, I'm sure.
Well, she is the aficionado. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Our music this week is by Lucy Dacus. It comes from the album No Burden. More information is at lucydacus.bandcamp.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Okay. Your dad seemed to have fun the weekend.
Oh, he loved it. He loved it. So that was great.
Good.
Now I got to come up with something to top it for next year's Father's Day.
So what else did you see besides all the stuff that we have to do for this show?
This is a packed show. So I've been watching the things we're going to be talking about. Mostly.
Yeah.
I did watch Scott Pilgrim again. And
yeah, I saw that. And you still
liked
it. It'll
come up next week. Oh, yeah. Just I haven't seen it or hadn't seen it since I reviewed it when it first came out and had the same exact feeling. The first, like, maybe 10 minutes of that movie are just this, like, energy jolt of inventiveness in terms of the characters and the use of graphics. And, yeah, it was just such a thrill. I'm like, this is exactly how I remember feeling when this came out on the screen.
I'd be shocked. I'd be shocked, honestly, if Edgar Wright ever made a bad movie.
Good question. Probably, what was the one after Shaun of the Dead? I'm blank.
Hot Fuzz.
Totally. Hot Fuzz is probably my least favorite.
Yeah, mine too, probably.
But it still has so much good stuff in it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, if he had made Ant-Man, maybe that would have been his bad movie.
Maybe.
You know, sometimes restricting yourself to formula will do it, but... yeah, it was so much fun. And what I can say is I went into it thinking Ramona Flowers would probably be my pick for the top five we're going to do, me and Angelica, next week, and came out of it thinking maybe it'll be Knives Chow, because that's nice. Such a fun.
Yeah.
She had much more to do in the movie than I remembered. Let me put it that way. So I got to figure that out before we record next week. But yeah, that's the only other thing I watched.
So I have no excuse for us recording so late other than the fact, and this isn't an excuse, that Sarah and I finally jumped into Making a Murderer.
Oh, okay.
On Netflix.
Wait, that's why you wanted to push the recording back?
I mean...
I thought you had to get to some of the titles that
I did. No, oh, okay. I did, but partly because I got obsessed with Making a Murderer.
I see.
And, you know, we were recording a little earlier the Monday night, and that's never good for me to get my head around that, but sometimes we have to do it. So I'm glad we pushed a little bit, but besides, well, I'll say first, you know this, because I told you, and I posted on Letterboxd, I'm not sure why we're not including it in the roundup other than we've got enough there. But Friday afternoon, I had a whole afternoon to myself because Sarah took the kids to go see my sister in Oswego and go swim. And so I had 6 or 7 hours to myself in the city. I said, okay, I'm going to go see a couple movies. So I saw Star Trek Beyond.
Okay.
But before that, I saw the new Woody Allen film, Cafe Society. And
that's right.
I'd mentioned it that... I was really anticipating this. I think it was one of my questions of the movie year, basically, could Woody kind of win me back? Because based on the trailer, the cinematography with Vittorio Storaro and Kristen Stewart and being set in Hollywood, I thought this was it. I thought this was going to be, and I didn't love, I keep saying this, but I wasn't blown away by Midnight in Paris the way so many people were, but I did like it a lot better than most of his recent output. I thought maybe this would be a return to form, and I didn't just not go for it. I hated it. I
more
mean,
than
I,
Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was the indication I was getting when I saw that. So are you done? Because this is the first Woody Allen film you've seen since...
Yeah, I mean...
You saw something since Blue Jasmine.
I don't feel like there's any split that has taken place, really, or needs to take place. I feel like nothing has changed insofar as the next time a Woody Allen film comes out, let's assume it does, that has promising elements like this one did, I'll probably go see it.
But I
haven't been in a hurry to see any of those
reasons. No, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Like, with as many new films coming out every year, and that number rises, the decision to watch a Woody Allen picture instead of one of those...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that just seems much harder for me to make. It's like, why would I even take the risk, or what's the impetus at this point? You know, and I haven't seen Cafe Society. Maybe I would like it. I don't know. I just have not had that urge in a long time. And I can list, like, if you're going to rank, here are all the titles I want to see this year. He just seems to be falling further and further down the line.
Yeah,
I guess that's what I mean by, are you done? Like, is there ever a way where he's going to
I've just
pop
been
up?
Like that. No, I don't think so.
Maybe
I mean, I've been that way for 10 years.
Maybe huge critical response.
Yeah,
you know,
if it did. And and this one, actually, I think really
you're the harshest,
in the minority.
Yeah, you're the harshest
I think
response
I have
I've
to
seen.
Be maybe the only critic who an hour in had to look at the time to see how much was left, because I was positive the movie had to be ending soon, and I was praying that it was. I mean,
we were only an hour in.
I was at that point. Well, and you know, his movies are only about 95 minutes usually, but I couldn't imagine that there were 35 minutes left, and I had no desire to sit through those 35 minutes. And the way I put it on Letterboxd is really the only way I can describe the experience of watching the film. This has been true of a lot of his recent stuff, too. I'm so hyper aware of characters who seem to be saying lines that they just don't believe. They don't believe it, and I don't believe it. I don't believe anything about the worlds he's creating, and the characters seem to be saying sort of stock Woody Allen lines.
Hasn't that been true for like almost decades now?
I don't know about decades, but I had never felt it as clearly as I had with this film. And the only one who can really escape it is Kristen Stewart. She really has turned into a fine, fine actress, and she is able to mostly transcend the material. Corey Stoll is another actor. He was in Midnight in Paris. He's another actor who is just a great presence, and he's really good on screen. But even Eisenberg, who I like and think is a really fine actor, seems so bored here. Seems so bored and so misused, and he really is like so many.
Is he doing Alan? Or
yeah.
Is he
yeah, he so, is. Yeah. And I would say that's another unfortunate thing. He's doing Alan more so than even other Alan surrogates do.
Hmm.
It's there in the voice, the little mannerisms. It's definitely a Woody impression, and just nothing about the story works. And here's a good example of why. Alan must have at least three, maybe four montages in the film where he just devotes a bunch of time to having a camera track through a space or pan through a space so he can deliver voiceover saying, like, we're at a nightclub. And it's like, over here is Legs or whatever the guy's name is, who's a local mobster. And then over here is so-and-so. And then they'll go to a Hollywood party and it'll be like, over here is this person. It's like, none of these people have anything to do with the story.
Wow.
They don't really add any color or really add any dimension. They feel like filler, and the whole movie's filler.
So he's sort of imposing himself on it as well by doing the voiceover.
Yeah, which is odd. I mean, I can't think of the last Woody Allen movie where he was the guy who was the voice.
I mean, the ones I've responded to in the last 10 years or so are those that have the least of him. So Vicky Cristina Barcelona, you could almost watch it not knowing it's a Woody Allen movie, almost Match Point in a way, although he has a tradition of those sorts of murder, murder dramedies. But what's the other one that, Cassandra's Dream, I even thought was interesting, but it's not, you know, there's not a lot of Woody in that.
No.
But he's using his, you know, gifts as a writer and, constructing narrative to put out good films.
Yeah.
But when he gets back into this same sort of vein, which seems where he's been primarily lately,
there's just a failing in the writing and in the visualization of the writing. And Steve Carell, another really fine actor, totally wasted here. And one of the ways you know he's wasted is because he's this kind of Hollywood mogul. But the only reason you know that, the only reason you know he's a man of charisma and charm and it has any kind of power and esteem in Hollywood is because Woody's voiceover keeps telling you that.
Mm.
There's nothing really about the way he behaves, the way he acts, the way others act towards him that conveys any of the things that Woody's voiceover tells you. It's a movie that needs its voiceover to give you all the subtext, really, that should be what makes the movie interesting, but it doesn't come through at all, so the voiceover has to suss it out.
And something a veteran filmmaker should not have to rely on.
But, okay, so Making a Murderer. Did you guys watch it?
No.
I remember all the hubbub. I think it came out around January. And
yeah, that sounds about right.
I remember saying to Sarah, because we just don't have a lot of things movie-wise in common that we don't go to movies together unless it's kind of a date night, and they're not the same kind of movies she anticipates that I do. And usually when I'm putting in some marathon movie or something to review on the show, that's her cue to duck out. And so she said to me on Friday night, I think she's like, are we ever going to watch Making a Murderer? You know, we don't have things we can watch together. Are we ever going to watch it? I said, I don't think I can. It just, I know that if I start it, I'm going to want to watch the whole thing. And
sure,
I don't know if I can afford to go down that rabbit hole, but I felt guilty. So we watched the first episode, and it was late at night after the kids had gone to bed. Even though it was a Friday night, it was really late. So we were able to, we were hooked, but we were able to go to bed and
cut it off.
And just cut it off. But then Saturday night, we started earlier, and she was ready to probably quit after three episodes, but we watched five.
Wow.
They're hour-long episodes.
Holy cow.
So from about 9:30 to 2:30.
Yikes.
With a few interruptions, we made it through five episodes.
That's a good test if it's really
Sunday, watch two more. Monday, watch two more. and finished off the entire series. And it's, you know, I don't know what this means. I'll say it's not great cinema, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of the style of it or anything like that. But that's not what it's trying to be. Clearly, it's a fascinating story that will infuriate, I think, anybody who sees it in terms of your faith in the justice system.
Okay.
And yeah, if you're watching it sort of hoping that everything's going to work out, well, you know, I couldn't wait to Google it and get an update. And I loved seeing that Making a Murderer season 2 is going to come out.
Right.
And there are supposedly some bombshells and new revelations. But I could see, just like people who got into Serial and I didn't go down that rabbit hole, I went down it with Making a Murderer, and yeah, I was hooked. I probably, if it wasn't for Sarah, I might have stayed up all night finishing it.
So you say it's not great cinema, but I wonder then, and I'm not asking this out of skepticism, just because this show and even the OJ one to a degree that was on AMC, I wonder what the distinction is between those and, say, something that would be, I don't know, on Lifetime or whatever network, you know, like true crime docudramas. This isn't like a newly invented genre.
No.
And I haven't watched a lot. I don't think I've seen any of those. I just know of their existence. And I clearly there are differences. But if it's not the cinematic difference between
right.
these, like, is it just exposure by being on Netflix? Or,
see,
or what is the quantifiable
right.
thing that something like Making a Murderer has that makes it stand
well,
that much apart?
I was afraid if I said that you were gonna force
I'm just,
this.
I'm just and, curious.
I know, and of course OJ is what I thought of too. Because if OJ is a movie, is it only a movie because they showed it as a movie? What is the distinction? I guess what I'm saying, there's a clear visual distinction between the credit sequence of Making a Murderer, which is very artfully done,
yeah,
and everything else visual about the movie. They're very clearly telling more of a news style. It's a news style production.
Okay.
And it's about nimble cameras, and it's not about the beauty of the shot aesthetically in
right.
any moment. But what elevates it, I think, from any of those types of Lifetime or those other crime dramas that are ubiquitous these days is really at its core the story, the commitment to the story, the clarity of the storytelling. It's just the breadth of it. It's
yeah.
the fact that it's not there for any kind of titillation of this is what happened next. It's not about that. It's about really getting into how this system works, who these people are, understanding them as people, really trying to uncover, because so much of the story is about how, in a couple of cases, well, I would just say it's very clear that these people are punished to an extent, the people who are punished, because of perception of who they are in this
sure.
town, and people being unwilling to have that perception altered in any way.
So more in line with something then, like Thin Blue Line or, you know.
Yeah.
And it sounds like certainly a distinction in terms of craft, but maybe more that these are more acts of journalism, more exercises
that's
in
what
journalism.
It is. Yeah. It's more reportage.
Makes
and
sense.
The fact that it covers 10, 11 years worth of activity.
Right.
That there's something to that. So yeah, I was obviously hooked.
All right. Add it to the list.
There you go. Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.